If you'll turn to 1 Peter chapter 1, we're going to move a little bit farther into the chapter this morning, and I would like to begin by reading verses 3 through 9. 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning with verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to His abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. To an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled, and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen you love, though now you do not see him, yet believing you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. I have done a lot of funerals in my life. I did one just a couple of weeks ago. And some funerals where they have the open casket, the person looks dead. I mean, there's just no doubt about the fact they are dead. They look dead. But there are some funerals where the person there in the casket looks better than they'd looked for a long time. My friend who died in Nashville a couple of weeks ago, she was 95. She looked 60 in that casket. That's just the way it is sometimes. Some people look dead. Some look very much alive, as if they're just sleeping. But the ones who look good in the casket are every bit as dead as the ones who look dead. And we have friends, we have family, we have neighbors who are good people, decent people, great people, happy people, helpful people, successful people. But if they're not in Christ, they are dead. And we should never forget that. The first blessing that Peter talks about there in verse 3 that has come as a result of God's mercy is that we have been begotten. We have been born again. And this isn't talking about baptism specifically in that word begotten. This word begotten is talking about what God has done to bring us to life. It's talking about God's initiative. It's talking about God's power, not about what we've done, but rather about what God's done. Verse 2 will help you unpack what's involved in being begotten. But the first blessing of Christ's mercy is that we've been made alive. That's what happens when someone is begotten. Life comes to that person. And those who are in Christ have life. And those who are in Christ have a living hope. That's the next thing that Peter mentions. Now, what are the components of the living hope that Christians have? Well, I think there are two parts to it. Going back to John chapter 14, Christ says to his apostles, "In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you." One of the things Christians hope for is a place. Not just any old, ordinary place. We're hoping for a wonderful place, a great place, a place that is worthy of being called a mansion. Don't we sing the song? I haven't sung it lately, but we used to sing the song, "I've got a mansion just over the hilltop." We sang that song. And there are some preachers, and I don't know why they get cranky like this, but there are some preachers who want to downplay the importance of the place that awaits those who have been begotten by God. I don't know why anybody would want to do that. Do you live in a comfortable house? Do you have in your imagination the ideal house? If you could live anywhere, it would be this kind of house. It might be a Tudor. It might be a federal house. It might be a ranch house. Every one of us has an idea of what would be a great place to live in, to have for a home. That's part of our happiness in life. That's part of our joy in life. Why would that not be part of the life of the believer after this life is over? Especially if Christ says that there is a place for us. And so that's part of the hope, the living hope that we have. The second part of the living hope is a person. There are some people, if you are with them, you don't care where you are. There is so much joy and pleasure in being in their presence, just being with them. You don't care where you are. You can be in a shack if you're with them. And that's what it's like to be with Christ. For me to depart, Paul said, and be with Christ is far better. Now, Christ talks about a place. Paul talks about a person. And both of those are part of our living hope that we have. Now, in verse 4, Paul is going to keep up this discussion of our living hope by talking about an inheritance. He starts out by saying we've been begotten by Christ's mercy. We have been begotten. And then he talks about inheritance. Inheritance is a thing of mercy also. You don't earn an inheritance. An inheritance is a gift someone decides to leave you, to give you when they're gone. It also is a thing of mercy. John, in John chapter 1, verse 16, in talking about Christ coming, the Word being made flesh, we've seen His glory, glory of the only begotten of the Father. And what we have seen, John says in verse 16, is grace upon grace. Grace piled on top of grace. So by grace we've been begotten. And then God keeps piling it on. And one of the things He piles on, being begotten, being born into life, is an inheritance. And Peter describes this inheritance in some detail. And again, this is part of our hope. Peter says this inheritance is incorruptible, or I think some versions may say imperishable. Let me tell you what is not imperishable. Chicken livers stuck under the front seat of the car that you forget about in summer are not imperishable. I did that one summer. I'd got some chicken livers to go fishing. And for some reason, I stuck them under the front seat of the car and forgot about them until about 2 days later. Sitting out there in the Illinois summer heat. And I smell something. And I can't figure out what I'm smelling. I'm thinking, has a mouse got inside this car, crawled up in here, and died? And it took me a while. I'm not very fast. You know, I'm kind of slow. It took me a while to remember those chicken livers I stuck under the seat. They were not imperishable. They were very perishable. I had to drive for about a month with the windows down every time I got out in the car to try to fumigate that thing. But our inheritance that we hope for is not like that. It's not corruptible. It is, Peter says, undefiled. My dad brought back from World War II a porcelain geisha doll for my grandmother. Mark's seen it. It's a beautiful piece of art. Dad's battalion was sent to Japan as temporary occupation troops, and when he finally got to come home, he bought that there somewhere and brought it back, and Grandma had that all those years, and we kids would go to Grandma and Grandpa's, and we'd get that thing out, and we'd play with it, and we'd mess around with it, and that thing is probably worth a lot of money right now. My brother Philip has it, but if we had chipped it, if we had broke the nose off of it, done anything like that, it would have been spoiled. It would have been ruined. But somehow or other, that thing made it through all the grandkids playing with that. And it remained intact. And because of that, retained its value. And then Peter says, thirdly, that it does not fade away. You know, kids sometimes tell their folks what they would like their folks to leave them when they're gone. I told Mom I would like this picture that I was with Dad as a little kid. We were at a farm sale that he bought of the Grand Canal in Venice. Beautiful picture in a really neat frame. I think Dad gave a quarter for it. It hung in my house, our house, all the time I was growing up. I told Mom I would like that. Philip said he wanted the porcelain doll. He got that. But sometimes we tell our parents what we would like. Have you ever heard of a kid asking his parents for the curtains? For the drapes? You know what happens when drapes have hung in a window for years? You take them down. You know what's happened? They faded. The part not in front of the glass may be okay, but all of the material in front of that glass has faded. And nobody wants faded drapes. Peter says this about our inheritance. It is untouched by death. It is unspoiled by evil. It is unimpaired by time. And that's the hope that we have. And so heaven has been reserved, Peter says. Our inheritance has been reserved. Have you ever reserved anything? Have you ever made a reservation for a plane ticket or for a car or for something like that? Have you ever reserved tickets at a concert or a ball game and you're going to pick them up at the will call office? And so you go there expecting to get your tickets because you paid for them and they're being reserved. And you go to the will call office and they get out a box that's got all these white envelopes and they start looking through them for your name. And you're just hoping that your name's there. It's supposed to be there. You reserve the tickets. Every once in a while, what you reserved is not there. But heaven will be there for us because Christ has reserved it. There is a place for us. I go to prepare a place. Our reservation is made to those who have been begotten, born again. And the reservation will be there. Now the other question is whether or not we will be there. It's one thing to make a reservation for a car or a flight on an airplane and then to show up. I mean, commercial air companies count on some people not showing up to claim the tickets they've paid for, and so they overbook because they want full planes. Now, yes, heaven's been reserved for us. The place is there. But can I get there? Well, verse 5. Who are kept by the power of God. You know, there are people who tell us the chances of us getting there and enjoying our reservation are slim. Preachers sometimes try to tell you, you don't have much chance of making it to heaven. Sometimes family and friends, enemies sometimes tell us that. More often than not, we tell ourselves that. 1 John 3:20, our hearts condemn us. Nobody knows us better than us. I never get worried about what anybody says about me. They don't know the half of it. I mean, they can't even get close to saying what they could really say about me. But I know what I can say about me. And my heart condemns me. And sometimes I think, no, I'm just not going to make it. And Christ steps in and says, I'm going to help you make it. I'm going to keep you. I'm going to guard you. I've got your reservation. I'm going to make sure you get there to enjoy your reservation. This word translated kept in verse 5 appears in Philippians chapter 4, verse 7. May the peace of God that passes understanding keep your souls, guard your souls. But Lord, I'm not good enough. Of course you're not good enough, but that's okay because your inheritance is by mercy. Verse 3. Your inheritance is a gift. Well, I just don't think I can make it. I know you've forgiven me, but I don't think I can make it to the end. I'll get you through to the end. That's what this word kept implies. That God is guarding us. And so what a great blessing that we have here by the mercy of Christ, being begotten, having a living hope, being kept for that revelation, verse 5, that's going to be revealed. It's ready to be revealed. The curtain's about to go up. And so we need the hope of verses 3, 4, and 5. But look now at verse 6. Verse 6 begins by saying, in this. In what? Well, in this, that you have been begotten, you have a living hope, your place is reserved, and you are being protected. You are being kept to make sure you can get there to enjoy your reservation. In this you greatly rejoice. Every one of us ought to leave. If we've read 1 Peter 1, 3 through 5, we ought to leave rejoicing today, no matter what our conscience tells us. If you're alive because you've been begotten again, you need to leave not just rejoicing, greatly rejoicing, and rejoicing in spite of the fact that now for a little while, if need be, we're grieved by various trials. Let's break that down. Suffering is not incompatible with our Christian belief. They are intertwined. Living the life of a Christian and yet suffering is intertwined. Coming to Christ does not remove us from the realm of suffering. Christ said in John 16, verse 33, in this world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. And so suffering is part and parcel of what it means to be a human being alive. Trials and Christianity are not separated, they are interwoven. And here's what Peter says about the trials. He says, number one, they're just for a little while. They're not going to last forever. Now, when we're hurting, when we're dealing with heartbreak, when we're dealing with pain, chronic, terrible pain, when we're dealing with a broken heart, it seems like it might never end. But pain is not going to last forever. The people to whom Peter was writing, they knew about suffering and tribulation. They were being persecuted for their faith. Peter says, it's not going to last forever. And what suffering produces is grief. You know what grief is? Grief is intense sorrow over something that's happened. Over some tragedy, over some ordeal, physical, more often emotional, spiritual. That's what suffering does. It gives us grief. Warren Wiersbe went to visit a lady in the hospital one time when he was a young preacher. And he went in, he was inexperienced about seeing people in the hospital. So he went and tells this lady laying there in the bed, I'm praying for you. And she said, well, what are you praying for? And that caught him by surprise. He hadn't thought that through. He says, well, I'm praying you get better and that God give you strength. And he went on like that. And finally she stopped him. She said, if you're praying for me, pray that I not waste this suffering. Suffering can make some people sweeter. It can make some people sour. It can make some people bitter. And Wiersbe said, you pray that I don't waste this suffering. And there's different kinds. Peter talks here about various trials, different kinds of trials. Suffering can hit us from all angles, from unexpected angles. And we sing that song, when peace like a river attendeth our way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, those words were written by a man who a year before he wrote those words had lost all of his daughters in a shipwreck as they were crossing the Atlantic Ocean. And he and his wife sailed to Europe following the path of the ship that his daughters took. And when he got to the spot in the ocean where his daughter's ship had gone down, when peace like a river attendeth my way. Trials he was not expecting, but finding peace in spite of that. So Peter says that our rejoicing is possible despite the various trials, the temporary trials that we encounter in this life, and that it's possible for us to be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Because we're kept by God, because He protects us through faith. Our faith enables incredible things to happen. Verse 8, look at the list of things there in verse 8. We've not seen Jesus with our eyes, but we love Him, and we believe in Him, and we rejoice with joy that is better felt than told, joy inexpressible. You just can't explain it. Full of glory. Belief is a powerful thing, folks. Faith can overcome the world, is what John says. And to put your faith on the resurrection of Christ, on the reality of Christ, on the revelation that Christ has given, gives you unbelievable power. Power that can make you joyful when the world is trying to destroy you. That's power. And so Peter talks about all of that, rejoicing in the salvation of our soul. When we are born again, we are saved from sin's penalty. As we live as a Christian, we are saved from sin's power. And when we go to heaven, we'll be saved from sin's presence. It won't be able to get at us any longer. Let me talk in closing just a little bit more about grief. Devastating moments in our life that we're often not prepared for. We can run from bad times, but we can't escape them because they will find us. We can banish bad things from our mind, but they will reemerge. Grief is a very real thing. Jesus, the prophet said, was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. What the Bible declares, our experience confirms. Grief is that life-shaking sorrow when we lose something. It can tear us to shreds. It can shake us from top to bottom. It can pull us apart to where we are coming apart at the seams emotionally. And the passage we quote from 1 Thessalonians 4:13 is that we sorrow, but not like those who have no hope. Now, just because we have hope doesn't mean we're not going to sorrow, we're not going to grieve. The fact of the matter is, sorrowing is important. When we suffer loss, grief is important. I'm not in favor. I'm going to tell you, I am not in favor of turning a funeral into a celebration. I mean, I've been to funerals where death is never even mentioned. As if somehow we don't mention it, that's going to make everything better here. I'm not in favor of that. Now listen, funerals have become the family reunion. I understand that. I mean, the only time some families get together is when someone dies. And I have no problem with the family getting together afterwards and going out and celebrating and laughing and telling stories and such. No problems with that at all. But grief is a horrible thing. The other day when I was working on these notes, I got an email from a lady I do some work for, copy editing down in Champaign. She said, would you do a sample edit on this book. And she sends the book. I had no idea what the book was about, but it was written by a number of women describing grief that they had dealt with in life. Let me read you what one lady wrote. "My beautiful girl had been struck down before the prime of her life had even started. How could everyone around me keep going about their lives? I was stuck in one spot, and what I can only describe as the feeling of wearing concrete boots made of grief that made it impossible to move forward. My healing tends to both spring forward and fall back. Grief comes in waves for me. It tends to ebb and flow. Sometimes it's easy to predict. Other days when I think I'm doing well, it hits me like a ton of bricks. I could be having a great time laughing with friends at an outing and just hear a song or get a whiff of a scent that reminds me of Kinsey, and I break out into tears. Sometimes when I'm in a crowd, I hear the word mom and turn to see if it was Kinsey talking to me. One thing I know is that I relive losing her every day. For just a split second, when I open my eyes in the morning, I think that my daughter's death was just a nightmare. I inevitably get out of bed, face my reality, and continue to think of new ways to honor her memory." That was a 17-year-old girl up in Northern Illinois a few years ago who, coming home from working a shift at a nursing home, she was 17, and she'd already become a CNA and worked in a nursing home. It snowed heavily that afternoon. She hit a patch of ice. Car went off the road and she was killed. That's grief. And a funeral, the word funeral comes from the Latin word that means death or corpse, something like that. A funeral is a time for grief. And I think funerals ought to be funerals for two reasons. We need a time to sorrow. And that's what happens at a funeral. We can express our sorrow. And number two, we need a time to reflect. That's Ecclesiastes 7:1. Solomon says, "The reason going to a funeral is better than going to a party, the house of feasting, is because that funeral, that obituary, that gathering of family is the end of us all. And the living will take it to heart." At funerals, people need to be confronted with the fact there's going to be a funeral for them one day. Are they ready to face that? Jacob, when he heard that Joseph was dead, refused to be comforted. He said, "I'm going to go down to my grave mourning." There are some people who, because they have no hope, believe that the only solution for the death of the one they have lost is their own death. They'll only find peace when they die. That's those who have no hope. We don't sorrow like that. We can be comforted over the loss of someone while we're still alive. And that's part of the living hope. That's part of the great blessing that we have. And so we don't deny life. We don't deny reality. We don't deny loss. We don't deny the hurt, the devastation. But we're saved by hope from terrible despair. And we can pick up our lives and go on. Peter really helps us to deal with the vagaries of life. And because of what he says, we can all leave here today greatly rejoicing. And I want to thank you for listening this morning.